The demon drink has long been celebrated in Ireland in song, but we also know that alcohol is a particular problem here. The most recent Alcohol Action Ireland figures suggest that 75% of all alcohol consumed here last year was done as part of binge drinking sessions. More than half, 54% of 18 to 75-year-old drinkers were classified as harmful drinkers. That's about 1.35 million people. It's a lot when you think about it in such a small country. Now, with all this serious drinking going on, you'd think we'd know a heck of a lot about how alcohol works. But it seems we don't. Alcohol is the only recreational drug about which scientists know very little. Until recently, not only were they in the dark on how we actually get drunk, they knew even less about our ensuing hangovers. They still don't know a lot. I'm joined now from Berkeley in California by a man who probably knows more than most. Adam Rogers is senior editor at Wired magazine, and he's written a book, Proof, the Science of Booze. So, Adam, what do we know? What are the basics?
It turns out to be a long story, as the saying goes. But part of this, I think, comes down to fundamentally fermentation and distillation for me. So fermentation is yeast, this fungus that we humans have tamed and taken advantage of its ability to eat sugar and excrete ethanol, excrete the kind of alcohol that we drink. And that's true of every fermented drink. That's true of wine and beer and pulque that they make out of agave across cultures. That it's the same process. And then what we humans learned to do about 2,000 years ago, depending on which history you believe or buy, is build the technology that concentrated those flavors. We learned how to make stills and learned to distill, and took those fermented products and ran them through a technology that used heat to turn it into vapor and then recondense that vapor into a liquid, and we drink those as well. And every distilled spirit is made that same way, with some subtle variations in the technology. And those two things, that natural process that we harnessed and then that technological process that we invented, are at the heart of a lot of what we would call civilization right now, a lot of what makes us not just Homo sapiens, but people.
Yeah, you make an extraordinary claim, a very big claim, I won't say an extraordinary claim, in your book. You say that several thousand years ago, when some unknown tribe began producing alcohol, it was, you say, the single most important event in human history. And there I thought the wheel was really important, and being able to communicate and speak and all that kind of stuff.
Sure. Listen, you could nominate other technologies. Language is a good one, like you said, especially written language. The wheel's good. Fire is an excellent chemical reaction that we humans have learned to use to great effect, I think. So I'm being intentionally hyperbolic there. But I do believe that once we humans started adapting natural processes and making them part of our daily lives, using them to improve our daily lives, that was the moment that we became scientists, that we became technologists, and that we became civilized people. There's a reason that archaeologists and anthropologists argue about whether when human beings started to plant grain and settle down in farms and then eventually in towns and cities, whether that was because they were chasing bread or beer. The question is, why were we doing that? Why did we domesticate crops? Why did we domesticate yeast to ferment those crops? We did it, I'm arguing, because we were chasing booze. And the oldest evidence that people were doing that is about 10,000 years old. It comes from an archaeological site in China called Jiahu. And nobody really knows why the person there was making something alcoholic, whether it was for some kind of ceremonial ritual reason, or whether it was just to have a party, or whether it was because it was part of the cuisine then. But 10,000 years tracks about with the time when people stopped kind of wandering around the various plains and belts and flatlands where we were and started settling into cities.
So when did we actually start studying alcohol?
Well, I kind of traced the key moment, at least for the study of it, to the mid to late 1800s. Up until that point, even though people had been fermenting for consumption for, 9,000 years, nobody really knew what fermentation was. And it wasn't until a young up-and-coming scientist named Louis Pasteur tried to figure out what caused fermentation and finally proved the hypothesis that had been floating around for a couple of decades, that in fact it was the yeast. It was this stuff, this fine kind of pulp that people found in a fermenting product that was actually alive and that was doing that, that was causing fermentation, that was the agent of fermentation. And it's sort of amazing to me to imagine a world where there are entire businesses. The wine industry was a multi-million dollar thing. The beer industry was multi-millions. Even then, right, in the mid, late 1800s, and nobody knew how it worked. which is sort of okay because you have these artists, these craftspeople doing it over and over again the same way until something goes wrong with the process. When something breaks in your process and your factory doesn't work anymore, as happened when Pasteur was working in a town called Lille in France, and a guy trying to make alcohol out of sugar beets was having a real problem with his fermenting. You didn't know what to do about it because you didn't know how fermenting worked. And it was Pasteur's early work before he started getting into things like rabies and pasteurization and food health. Before he did all that, he was working on wine and beer.
I'm told that it's relatively difficult for modern science to study the effects of alcohol. Is that true?
It's true, in part because the effects are so different on different people. The effects of alcohol on you are probably a bit different than they are on me, and that's true from person to person. It's certainly true from culture to culture. Different cultures around the world have very different, report very different effects from consuming alcohol, both in small amounts, you know, that sort of one drink, two drinks amount, versus all the way through getting really drunk. But also, when you're studying the effects of a chemical, what you really want to be able to do is have a placebo. You want to be able to give this chemical to a group and give the same test circumstances to a different group without the active chemical and look at what the differences are as a way of breaking out what the effects of the chemical are. It turns out to be really hard to give somebody a placebo beer. People can tell. They know that they're not getting alcohol.
Well, I don't totally agree with you there, I have to say, because I know of an instance of a guy who told me that when he was young and he worked in London many years ago in a hotel, and they to make a few quid on the side, he told me this, whether it's true or not, I don't know. What they would do when there were parties on is they'd have little jars or saucers, rather, of spirits behind the bar. And if somebody ordered a spirit, whether it be a vodka or a brandy or a whiskey, they would just rub the rim of the glass in the whiskey and fill the rest of it with water. Water pretty much and a little drop of whiskey, and he said he saw the people getting drunk.
That's actually the way that they started studying it in research labs at universities. Now people can tell a little bit better than chance whether they're getting a placebo or not if they're in a laboratory setting. But in fact, in about the 1960s, a researcher named Alan Marlatt figured out a drink. It was basically a weak vodka tonic, or vodka soda, excuse me, that he could make with the vodka and without the vodka, and that nobody would be able to tell better than chance whether it had alcohol in it or not. And what that enabled him to do was set up not just two groups in the study, which is to say placebo or alcohol, but also two other groups, which was somebody expecting to get alcohol and not getting it, which is what you're describing in that bar, the people who thought
they were getting the taste of it.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Just on their lips.
They were getting all the circumstances because they were in a bar, and this is the important part. They were in a bar. They were getting all the other social cues that they were getting a drink. Mm-hmm. And so in Marlatt's work and the people who studied with him and the work that they still do today, they build simulations of bars in their laboratories. In a lab, a thing that looks and feels just like being in a bar with music and bar stools and a bartender and bottles behind the bar and the lighting is low with a one-way mirror with glass so that you can observe what happens to them. Because then you get these two groups. You get a group of people who have either think they're getting booze, think they're getting alcohol and are not, or even more interesting, people who don't think they're getting alcohol and are. Right? Then you can begin to test, well, what are the actual effects? What actually happens to somebody when they have ethanol in their system versus what happens because they think they're getting ethanol? What are the what expectancies, that's the term that the sociologists and anthropologists use, are being fulfilled when they consume alcohol?
What do they come back and say? What have they noticed?
Well, the only thing that ethanol seems to have in common across cultures is that it does seem to increase a person's proclivity to violence. And it's one of the only recreational drugs that people consume that has that consistently. We tend to think of drugs as being violent, especially the illegal ones. But really, it's the markets around those illegal drugs that are violent. The drugs themselves, with a couple of other exceptions, tend not to make people violent. Ethanol seems to have that effect across the board.
Why is it that makes people violent?
Now you're asking a question that, if you could figure out a way to answer it, could get you quite a lot of money and a grant to do a research study. Because unlike all those other recreational drugs, ethanol, alcohol, is the only one that human beings consume for which researchers have really not fully articulated a mechanism for how it works. So if you go press a neuroscientist on what happens in the brain when somebody has two drinks in them, they will have to say, we are really not quite sure. They have some ideas, but they're not quite sure.
Do we know anything about hangovers? Because the one thing you can expect if you drink a lot is a hangover.
Unfortunately, almost everything that people get told about what causes and cures hangovers turns out, at minimum, to not be proven by science, and at maximum, probably to not be true. Basically, if you drink too much, if you get yourself up to 0.1 blood alcohol, you're going to be hungover the next day. But it makes no difference which drink you have. So there's that idea that if you stick to so-called pure spirits, like if you just drink vodka, you know, because there's no toxins in it. It doesn't have congeners, anything that's not ethanol or water, like, let's say, whiskey, that you won't get hungover. And that's not true at all, as anybody with any experience of this stuff knows, but people will tell you that it might be dehydration. Well, it is true that alcohol does dehydrate. It suppresses something called the antidiuretic hormone. It's also called vasopressin, which is a chemical that the body makes to keep you from peeing too much, frankly. So when you drink, then your body forgets that, and you end up peeing a lot more. Also, if you're drinking a lot, you're probably not drinking water at the same time, unless you make a conscious effort to do that. Mm-hmm. So it is true that you get dehydrated, but it's also true that you can make sure that somebody is rehydrated or doesn't get dehydrated, and they still are hungover. It doesn't help. So it's not hangovers. The sugary drinks thing also turns out not to prove out. Doesn't matter how much sugar is in the drinks. You still get a hangover. It can still be just as bad. The only thing that researchers have found, and I should say, too, there's really not a lot of research on hangovers, weirdly, for something that affects so many people and actually costs as much money in lost work hours that it does. There seems to be kind of a stigma about doing the research, that people worry that if you came up with a way to cure hangovers, that would be like encouraging people to drink more.
But do you have any suggestions for cures for hangovers?
Well, I have a couple, but I should preface them by saying that I am a journalist and not a doctor, and you'd probably be foolish to take medical advice from me. But because one thing that hangovers do seem to have in common is they are an inflammatory response, like if you have the flu. It's your body's immune system overreacting to something. So notionally, anti-inflammatories ought to work. So things like, where you are, paracetamol, but we would say acetaminophen or ibuprofen, things like that. Now, of course, if you take a lot of those have other side effects,
yeah,
so you don't want to be
set your tummy and all that kind of stuff. We wouldn't be recommending people take them over the air anyway.
That's right. There are a couple of the over-the-counter hangover remedies that have been shown in small but decent scientific studies to have some effect. So as an example, there's a vitamin B6 analog called peritanol that seems to have some effect. There's an extract of prickly pear cactus that seems to have some effect. And there's a chemical called dihydromyrcetin. It comes from the ancient Chinese pharmacopoeia, Chinese medicine, from a plant called Hovenia or Oriental raisin. That seems to have an effect on some of the receptors in the brain that are affected by alcohol. I've tried a bunch of these things and found them to be, let's say, not as helpful as one might want.
You did a lot of research for this book. What was the biggest surprise you found during your research?
As I mentioned, the paucity of information that scientists have about what ethanol actually does in the brain was pretty shocking to me. I expected to get a much better story from the neuroscientist than I did about what ethanol was doing. The chapter in my book about that ends up being about all the difficulties that a researcher encounters when trying to study ethanol. The other one that I like, and I knew this a little bit going in, but it was nice to have it reinforced, was all of the different things that different cultures make into something alcoholic. So we're familiar with grains. That's an obvious one for beer and for whiskey, or grapes that turn into wine or brandy. But I just recently found out that in China, they will make a distillate from fermented horse milk. So I knew about the fermented horse milk because in Central Asia, they make something called kumis. Horse milk turns out to be the only mammalian milk with enough sugar in it, it's lactose, that yeast can eat and ferment. All the other milks don't have enough sugar, so you can't make a fermented product out of it. Horse milk does. I didn't know that you can actually take that and distill it, too. You can make a distillate, a clear spirit, out of horse milk. Never had it. I would really like to try it.
Tell me, has writing the book changed your own personal drinking habits?
It did change my habits a little bit. I now order very weird. I order whatever the thing is behind the bar that I've never seen before. I want to know what the thing is I haven't tasted, which is fun. I don't have a usual. You know, I'm very novelty seeking in my drinking habits.
But now, it hasn't put you off alcohol.
You know, it's funny. You kind of busted me there. I think that it's not the wasn't the research, it's just the age. My tolerance for alcohol has gone way down. My hangovers are much worse than they used to be. This is really just in the last 3 or 4 years. I am no longer the extreme drinker that I perhaps once was.
Can I ask you, Adam, is that an age thing? Can I ask you how old you are?
I'm 43.
Okay, because I have noticed, certainly as well in the last few years, I just simply can't drink anymore.
It is the case that with age, we lose our ability to process as quickly, and we lose our ability to recover as quickly. That's for sure. You can develop a tolerance. You know, I think we all know people who, even as they get older, because they're such professional level drinkers, they can consume way more. And also, you know, body mass plays a big role here too. If you're just physically bigger, then you can handle your alcohol better than those of us who maybe are a little bit wee, perhaps. But it does change, and we do get worse at it as we get older.
Well, I'm glad, because I have less interest in having a drink at all now. I have to be honest and say, one glass of wine, and that's pretty much it. I have no interest in having any more if I'm out for an evening. But at any rate, Adam, thank you very much indeed. A fascinating insight, and if you want to read more, you can get a copy of Adam's book. All the details are on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. The book is called The Science of Booze.